From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange. Since 1975, more than 30,000 refugees have traveled to Iowa searching for a new home. They're fleeing war and persecution in countries halfway across the world. Iowa's resettlement programs began with Governor Robert Ray during the Vietnam War. Now, 35 years later, two of Iowa's three refugee resettlement agencies are suspending their programs due to financial constraints. The economy and stagnant federal funding have made relocating more difficult, and families already residing in Iowa are now concerned about bringing loved ones to the state. This hour on The Exchange, we'll take a look back at Iowa's history with refugees and examine the future of resettlement in Iowa. That's coming up next, but first, the news. I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange. Iowa has had a long history of resettling refugees. Last year alone, more than 900 found a home in Iowa. But next year, the number will fall to 130 as two of the state's three resettlement agencies suspend their programs. Coming up later this hour, we'll speak with the head of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services, one of the agencies closing its doors. And we'll also speak with a program director at Catholic Charities in Des Moines, the sole agency continuing to resettle refugees next year. But we begin our conversation this hour with former Iowa Governor Robert Ray, who first encouraged Iowans to assist in the settlement of Southeast Asian refugees in the 1970s during the Vietnam War. The governor was initially responding to a call from President Ford, but over the next few years began to actively seek out refugees he witnessed on television and during travel to Asia. Over the next decade, Iowa became home to many Vietnamese, Laotian, and Cambodians. Governor Ray, thank you for being with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you, Jalene.
What is your reaction to the news that both the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services and also Lutheran Services are suspending their resettlement programs?
Well, it was surprising, and yet it shouldn't be because of the times in which we live. But they've done a remarkably good job, and it's kind of sad to see them disappear.
When you first got into this effort so many years ago, more than 30 years ago, did you expect it to continue as long as it had?
No, I didn't. Of course, that wasn't on my mind. On my mind was, how do we save lives? And Iowans stepped up, and they literally saved lives. And that was our mission, and we've been richly rewarded as a result. I've said many times, if you help people for the right reason, you'll be rewarded, and we certainly have been.
As you look around the world today, do you think there's more work to be done? Do you think more could be resettled in Iowa?
Well, I think so. It's not quite as dire as it was at that moment. These people were being rushed out of their countries and had no place to go. And can you imagine what it would be like to lose part of your family, lose all of your possessions, have nothing, and be shipped off to another country where you didn't know the culture, didn't understand it, couldn't speak the language, and had nothing? That's beyond comprehension, and yet that's what was happening. And our Iowans stepped up and said, we will help, and certainly they did.
I referenced that you initially responded to a call from the president asking governors to help resettle these refugees, but it went beyond that for you.
Well, that was the original part of it, and we said we'd take our share. Then I received a letter from Arthur Crisfield, who had been with the State Department, was in that part of the world, and he wrote all the governors in the country and the leaders in Canada and England and asked for help for the Thai Dam, because these are people who had no country and they wanted to stay together to have a little bit of good feeling as they resettled. And
they'd been pushed from Vietnam, is that right?
Yes. And from Laos at that moment. And so there was one governor who stepped up and said, we will help, and that was I. And I've never apologized for that. I've never felt that it was a bad decision. On the contrary, it was a good decision. And we did some research and found that the Thai Dam were very moral people. They were good family people. They were good workers. And so I said, we'll take them. And we did some preliminary work to find places for them to stay and people to support them, families to support them. And then we ran into an obstacle, and that was the State Department had a provision that said you could not settle a group of people in one location. And that was understandable. You know, you don't want to dump a lot of foreigners into one school district, as an example.
That isn't prepared for it.
They couldn't have been. And so that was understandable. But we felt there should be an exception. So I went to the White House, talked to President Ford. I went to the Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. And between the two of them, they made the decision to support what I was asking. So we got the exception. And these people came to Iowa.
After that, that might have been the end of it, yet you traveled to Asia. You saw a documentary on TV which caused you to have some concern about another group of people. Talk to me about your continued interest in this.
Well, that was a little bit later when we were in the office at 10 o'clock at night and had the television set on, and Ed Bradley came on, and he had 60 Minutes, and he showed the boat people where they were trying to escape in these frail little boats, and they were breaking up, and people were dying and drowning. And it was just very, very tragic. It was at that time that I dictated a letter to send to then-President Jimmy Carter, saying that if he opened up the doors again, why, we would accept some of these people. And that happened. I traveled to Thailand and that part of the world, with several governors. Billy, my wife, was with me, and Ken Quinn was then in my office. And
now former ambassador, but he previously worked for you.
Exactly. And we saw 30,000 people out there in mud fields, lying there with almost no clothes and nothing to eat. And it was just so sad, and it was so earth-shaking just to watch. And we came back, and the Des Moines Register was very supportive. David Jepson met me at the airplane and took my pictures and had them developed and then ran them in the Des Moines Register. And that's how we started Iowa Shares, which meant that we would share food and drugs and what have you. And Ken was masterful in developing that effort. And between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we raised about $600,000 to help those dying people. They were dying 50 to 100 a day over there. And Iowan stepped up and did something that no one else was doing. And it was very, very significant. And again, Iowans saved lives.
What you did is widely applauded now, and bringing refugees is applauded. But at the time, was it more controversial?
Well, incidentally, let me say that $600,000 would be about $1.5 million today, mm-hmm. in 30 days.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? And I think there's some significant differences now, particularly with the illegal immigrants, which I just hesitate to even talk about it because it's so different than what we were doing. What we were doing and what these people were doing was legal and, again, saving lives.
And so do you think that because of some Americans' concerns about illegal immigration, that it taints the refugee programs because they paint it maybe with the same brush?
Well, I think some people might do that, and I just hope that's not widespread because there is a significant difference.
Why did you think Iowa could be a home for refugees or would be a good home for people that, as you said, did not speak the language, did not know the culture?
Well, we were not diverse, and there is some real value in diversity. But I felt that here we are in this beautiful land and not overcrowded and, frankly, needing people to go to work. We needed jobs filled, and so we were it was a very logical place. And most people were very supportive. Now, I will agree that there were some that were really doubtful and didn't approve, but they were in the minority. Maybe you've heard me tell the story about the woman who wrote me and was very, very critical and said, how would you dare bring foreigners here and take jobs from us? I don't have a job. And so we did some checking to see how many advertisements there were in the paper for looking for people for jobs. And so I called the woman, and she started out by railing the same as she had written. And then when she calmed down, I said, "Well, will you listen to me just a moment?" I said, "There are so many ads in the paper for people to go to work." I said, "Go out and get a job before these people ever come." Big pause. And she said, "I get the point."
You won her over. From your perspective, though, what did Iowa gain? Because I know you've said we gave them a home and they gave us so much. What did they give us? What have they brought?
They gave us a work ethic. They went to work. They provided some good service for businesses that were looking for employees. And they've even started some companies. We've had one who was elected to the school board, that type of thing. When the Amerasian group was formed, they came to me and talked to me about it. And I said, "Well, I think that's very nice, but we want you to be Americans." "Well, that's the reason we're doing this." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "What do you want us to do for you?" "Oh, no, that's not what we want. We want to do for this state and this country. We want to come together so we can be helpful." And that was their attitude, and I think it still is.
And what did it do for our state's image? Because, you know, in the center of the country, we must not have been well known to many parts of the world, but yet here was Iowa opening its doors to refugees. Did it put us on the map in some places?
Well, I mentioned the trip to that terrible site of that field with 30,000 people. There was a little house, a little wood kind of cabin, and inside we went, and there was a big Iowa Department of Transportation map with pins stuck in it where people had relocated, had come to Iowa. And I thought at that time, you know, who would have ever dreamed that halfway around the world, a place where we didn't speak their language, they didn't speak ours, was a map from Iowa. And so I think we did get to be known, and I think people admired Iowa and still do.
Do you hope that refugee resettlement continues in the state?
Oh, I would hope so. I think there is indeed value to that, and we learn from each other, and we're not isolated. We're not just a little pinpoint. We're part of the world, and we should be a leader.
Governor Ray, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for your interest.
After the break, we'll speak with the head of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services and also a program director at Catholic Charities in Des Moines. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck, and we're discussing the state's refugee resettlement agencies. Two of the three are discontinuing their programs due to financial constraints, ending a long tradition in Iowa that began in the 1970s when thousands of Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians escaped war and persecution coming to Iowa. Since then, Iowa has welcomed refugees from other countries as well, including Africa, Bosnia, and Iraq. In July of 2007, Nong Tang resettled from Iowa from Malaysia, and he is joining us now to discuss his trip to the United States and his resettlement here in Iowa. And also joining us, Abdikari Youssef from Somalia, Kenya. You also came 2 years later in 2009. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Tong, let me begin with you. Explain to me a little bit about how you became aware of Iowa and the process to come to Iowa.
When I was in Malaysia as a refugee and waiting for resettling, then we have a chance to resettle in the United States, and I didn't know that I'm going to Iowa. And when I had an interview with UNHCR, I have a friend in Iowa, Des Moines. Mm-hmm. I don't know the state.
You hadn't heard of the state?
Yeah, I haven't heard of the state. And then when I find out Des Moines is the capital of Iowa, And then, oh, it's Iowa. And then I look into the Google and everything. And then, long story to the short, I came to Des Moines, and I met with a friend, and I came through Bureau of Refugee Services. And all of them are very nice to me. And then, for sure, I never envisioned this life. Mm-hmm. And I never think that I will come to USA when I was in Malaysia. And it's become a good life, a new, there's a lot of things to learn, a new, mm-hmm. new things. And for me, it's a little bit okay that I speak a little bit of English.
Before you came.
Before I mm-hmm. came, yeah. And, but I still have to learn in order to get a proper job and in order to get a good job. And the education that I had is much different from United States. So, but I'm still on the process of all those things. And there's a lot of new culture, and this is a great change, mm-hmm. great change life. Mm-hmm. And people save our life.
Well, yeah. Tell me about what you left. I mean, why you left and the necessity to come here.
I fled Burma because of religious persecutions. In 1997, I was doing literature evangelical in the middle part of Burma, now they call it Myanmar. Mm-hmm. And the military officer came to me. When I do the literature evangelical, I have to go house to house, spreading the word of God, sharing through the book and how Jesus came to the world and saved our life. When they found out that I was doing all those things, they came to the house that I live, and they arrest me. And they put me in a dark house for 2 or 3 days. I couldn't see outside. And when they give me a food, I can see the light. I still remember it mm-hmm. today. I can't forget that. And then they forced me to labor to porter. At that time, there was a fire between the current undergrounds and the Burmese military. And then they forced me to porters, and they put me on the military truck, and then they sent me to the jungle part. From then, I could manage to escape, and I fled first to India, and then I have a chance to learn English, and I have a chance to continue the study in India for 3 years.
Before coming to
the United States. Mm-hmm. After 3 years, living in India is very difficult for us, living in the jungles, and there's nothing to do. So I have a connection with a friend in Malaysia. So because of my friends helped me, I get through Malaysia. Malaysia is still very difficult, the situations in Malaysia, that we live in the city, the police, and they call RELA. They are cracked down the illegal immigrants, especially. There's a lot of refugees. And
you're not entirely welcome there.
Yeah, they are not welcome. And when they arrest us, they put on detentions, and then they deport mm-hmm. to Thailand. And then when they deport to Thailand, there's the agents. that who took the refugee, and there's a lot of human trafficking. There's a lot of people missing between this if they don't have connections to each other. So there's a lot of risks and a lot of dangerous thing in Malaysia, especially for refugee. And then a week ago, I got a call from a friend of mine in Malaysia. There was a refugee died, and the government doesn't allow, the Malaysian government doesn't allow them to bury it. That's the body. That before we, they allow the refugee to bury it in the cemetery.
To be buried.
To be buried. Right now, they don't allow. So there's a lot of difficulty in Malaysia. It's going on. I think it's the same thing to Thailand, and because we are not living in our country, we are displaced people, and we live at different people's territory. So, you know, we don't have identifications, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult.
That being said, as you tell me your story, did you come to the United States then alone, and do you have family that you would like to bring to Iowa as well, or have you settled by yourself?
I came along to the United States. My family is still in Burma. It's in the northwest of Burma. It's in Chin State. And my mom and my stepfather, and I have two sisters. My sister, my next sister, he's in Malaysia right now.
And do you have hopes that you can work through the refugee resettlement program to bring any of your family here? Or
I've been learning a lot of process to bring them there. I found out that I could bring them here after I got citizens if I have a chance. I will be still learning because there's a lot of new things, new immigration policy changes. That's why I have a large willingness to join together here in Des Moines and Iowa or United States.
We only have just a little bit of time left before the break, and then we'll also speak with you. But let me ask, what was the single largest adjustment? I mean, I can't even imagine, you know, you move to a country where it is not the language you grew up with, it is not the culture you grew up with. Has there been a single largest adjustment?
There's a lot of thing we need to adjust, as you said, cultural, language first, and cultural. When a refugee immigrant came to the United States, the purpose is that their self-sufficiency. In order to get self-sufficiency, we have to do a lot of things. If we don't speak the language, there's a long way to get self-sufficiency.
Language is the first hurdle.
Yeah, language is the first hurdle. And then the work we need to learn. The work we had in Burma, the farmer, we call farmer. That farmer is that some kind of we hold.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll talk about that when we come back. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck. We're talking about refugee resettlement. Time is 12:36. I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. We're discussing the state's refugee resettlement agencies. Two of the three are discontinuing their programs this year. Joining me right now is Nong Tong, who in July of 2007 resettled from Malaysia. And before the break, you were telling us a bit about the differences in farming between your home country and Iowa. How did you find work? And let me ask you about the Bureau of Refugee Services, because was that an assistance to you when you came?
When I came, Bureau of Refugee Services helped me find a job for employment service. The difference between the employment in Burma and America is when we call Burma, a farmer, in Burma, we have to do a hard, very hard, but that's totally different from America. In America, a farmer is only rich people, as far as I know.
I think they would. That's a characterization they probably don't agree with in their minds. But I understand it's a different lifestyle here, of course.
Yeah. When the employee interviews, what is your experience in Burma as a farmer? Oh, you're a rich people. So that's the refrain. Mm-hmm. And
could you have found work without the Bureau of Refugee Services? Or
yeah,
was it?
I found a job. My first job is in interpreter at mm-hmm. Lutheran Social Service. Mm-hmm. And then Bureau of Refugee Service itself gave me a job as a caseworker there.
So it's been instrumental in making this a positive experience as opposed to something that could be, I mean, it's already scary, but even worse.
Yeah. It's kind of.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Youssef, you came to the United States in 2009.
Yeah.
From Africa.
From Kenya.
From Kenya. What brought you here? What were you leaving behind?
It's kind of long story, but in the start, I just came. I and my family flee from Somalia to the neighboring country, Kenya. Mm-hmm. And that time, I was a little kid or an infant, and I was moving with my family. Then, because they just told me all those stories back then when I just grew up, and it was because of the civil war broke up in Somalia.
So, did you come not individually, but with family members?
Here in the United States, mm-hmm. yes.
How many?
I believe we are a family composed of 12, mm-hmm. a large family.
That had to be easier, in a way, feel more secure than coming by yourself.
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. And talk to me about, you came and were you helped in resettling from Catholic Charities?
Well, I think we are helped by Catholic Charities mm-hmm. and just came here. And when we were back there in Kenya, we have been responsible by IOM, International Organization for Migration, and all the expense that we came to the United States has been paid by the Catholic Charities. Mm-hmm. So I believe Catholic Charities played an active role for our resettlement here in the U.S.
How important, then, is that program in making a successful transition?
Well, I guess it's a successful transition because it seems like our lives is changing and we're just making a progress.
Have you been able to find work and education and the kind of things that you might have wanted to find in a new country?
Yeah, I just got an opportunity to just continue my education here in the U.S. Part of my family got a job opportunities here in the U.S.
Okay. And what has been one of the biggest obstacles that they've helped you overcome, that you've had assistance in overcoming?
Well, first, when we came here in the United States, it's hard to just adapt with the culture and mm-hmm. how things work.
Did you speak English before you came over?
Yeah, I do speak English when I came here with a British accent, but mm-hmm. I'm just trying to just change it into an American accent now here in the U.S., and then they help us to just adjust with the culture and how things work in the U.S. And when we had a question arise in our family, we used to contact them by either phone or walking into their business area, then asking them questions or how to deal with this with those staff.
All right. I want to bring on now John Wilkin, the Bureau Chief of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services, and also Sol Varisco, Poverty Reduction Director for Catholic Charities Migrant and Refugee Services. Thank you both for being with us. We've heard the stories of two who have resettled in Iowa and have found some success. Continuing education has found employment. But how difficult is that transition, Mr. Wilkin? And are you saddened to be leaving that program?
Yes, it's a mixed experience. I've shared with others that it's hard to be too sad because we were very privileged to have 35 years. And as Governor Ray was saying to you before, no one ever visioned that we would be doing this for this long, and we've had a very unique role in it. So from that standpoint, I think we've gone well beyond what anybody ever thought. The biggest concern I think that we have right now is you were talking to Nong and, mm-hmm. and others who still have family members who want to come. And with the reduction in capacity with only one agency instead of three, one of the concerns that we all have in the refugee service community is how are those people going to be accommodated? It's not an issue of will they come to the United States. The difficulty is will they be able to come to Des Moines or not? And it's unlikely that all of the families who are here who have relatives still to come are going to be able to be initially resettled in Des Moines because, as you've indicated, mm-hmm. we're going down to maybe 130 individuals a year. I'm sure we have
when it was
more,
900 last
right,
year.
And I'm sure that we have more individuals in what we call the pipeline waiting to come who have relatives here than that 130. So that's a big challenge.
And let's just back up a step. I think one of the things that many listeners may not understand is what are the services you provide? We've done some news stories on it. They may have heard that. But when someone resettles in Iowa, what is your agency providing?
Well, any agency that's involved in the initial resettlement is under a contract with the U.S. Department of State, and they have what they call core services. And just to sum them up very quickly, meet the client at the airport, secure housing for them, make sure that they have minimum furnishings and food and clothing, help individuals apply for Social Security cards, enroll children in school if they have school-age children, refer the employable adults for employment services and schedule initial medical examinations. And so that's just a real quick summary of what any agency would need to be doing. So I don't forget this, our office is not closing, but this piece of our program is ending. We will continue to do the employment services for refugees, and we will continue to be in the mainstream welfare system, what's known as the Promise Jobs Program. Any refugee who accesses that program will be assigned to work with our office. We have some other projects that we will continue to do. So we're not closing, but certainly this will be a big change for us in our operation.
You'll be providing fewer services. You will be providing services,
yes.
But not some of those initial services.
Correct. We will no longer be responsible for helping brand new arrivals. Souls Agency is mm-hmm. going to be the only one doing that.
And we want to talk about that, but let me just ask one more quick question before we do that. Was this solely a financial decision?
No. In our case, we have been, since Governor Ray's mm-hmm. day, we have been considered a national voluntary resettlement agency. There are currently 11. There have been 10 for a number of years. And at the goodwill of the Department of State, we've been allowed to have that status when technically we really haven't operated. We don't have offices across the whole country. So ultimately, this year, the Department of State made the determination that they can no longer grant us that status. So in addition to the financial challenges, we're losing that status as a national agency, and it was determined that we couldn't continue to do resettlement in a different model.
This came at the same time or near the same time that Lutheran Services decided to end its long tradition of working with Catholic Charities to resettle Iowans. And that really forced a tough decision for your agency. Your board of directors actually considered the same.
Yeah, it was a difficult decision. And what I will just add of what John said is that all those core services need to be served and happening in a period of 30 to 90 days. So that's the other challenge, too, to make sure that all the services are provided between that day, because that's what the contract says. But it was a difficult decision. Both of their decisions were public on the same day. So since then, we've been having a lot of meetings about the possibilities of continuing the program, because we think it's a justice issue as well, and how to do it in a more manageable way, trying to stay with the numbers that we've been doing, but trying to have a stronger team to provide more services. And I'm happy that the board got that decision last week.
And one of the things you indicated to me when we spoke, when that decision was made, was that, in part, federal funding had finally increased, mm-hmm. Per refugee, and that has helped, that allowed you to say, okay, we can do this a little longer.
Yeah, actually, that information also came on the same day. So we thought it was kind of like a God
a sign
that maybe we are going to be the ones continuing. So, yes, we analyze that. We also apply to other programs to bring more funding through the federal program as well that would allow us to extend services for another 3 months. But only half of the people that we will resettle can access to that. So it has some good and bads, but we were able to access to more money, and hopefully as we are going to be the only ones, we look forward to apply for other maybe private fundings as well.
And one of the things that Mr. Wilkin discussed that I know that you and I have discussed is that now that there is only one agency in Central Iowa doing this work, that you will focus largely on family members there is a pipeline to allow family members to come, and although a much narrower pipeline.
Yeah, we would like to concentrate on those cases. Sometimes we don't mandate that. Catholic Charities in our national, that is USCCB, United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, received the 24% of the overall of a refugee in the country. So sometimes, if nobody else take some cases, we will have to take it. In Iowa, again, we will try to concentrate on U.S. ties, as it's called, so relatives that already live here, and make the possibility of family reunification.
Do you foresee a time in the future when Lutheran Services or other agencies might resume this work now that there is a little bit more federal money, or do you think that this is kind of the future of the program in Iowa?
It's too soon to say. I think because of what John was saying, that probably our numbers are not enough with the demand that we have. Probably other agencies will open. I would like also to see agencies being involved in the long-term services, since we are just a short-term service provider. And I would like
so after 90 days, you're done with your contact with refugees.
Well, in papers, yes, mm-hmm. we are. But usually, we try to secure and keep providing services to make sure that they're going to be successful.
But you'd love some other agencies to begin work with refugees and long-term assistance, because can you imagine 90 days is not enough time to become acclimated to a new home?
Correct, and that is when the volunteers are really helpful, and all these churches have been stepping up. The state also keep providing services to them, but yes, if they are not self-sufficient by 90 days, it becomes harder.
Mr. Wilkin, this began 35 years ago. How has the state changed? Is it as welcoming? Is it more welcoming? You know, how's the face of Iowa changed?
I think there's always been a core of Iowans who have thought that this is a very positive thing to do. And this predates the program. It goes back to what was called the Displaced Persons Program after World War II. It could go back even further than that. But it cycles. It cycles by what's going on in the world, what's competing for interest. But I've been with the Bureau for 23 years, and I've never had a period where there aren't people stepping up and helping and thinking it's a good thing. So I think in general, that's always been the case. When the economy is bad, of course, people start to look at feelings that people from other countries perhaps are impacting the job market. And that's understandable. Others are hurting. But Iowa has really been welcoming. I think Iowa has benefited from it. We're much more diverse than what we were. And I'm a big believer in diversity. And I think that's a positive. And at the national level, no one wanted to see the programs reduced in Iowa. They all I'm talking about the national players, all really wanted to keep the numbers where they were. It was just circumstances that caused the changes, starting with Soul's Parent Body and the Department of State and Office of Refugee Resettlement, overseas programs. All of them think that Iowa is a good place to come. And, you know, maybe there will be another national office that will decide to open an office here, which would be great, I think, for the refugee program. But our first priority is to make sure that Soul's program is viable and can operate, because we know refugees need the safety net of still having a way to get resettled and reunified with their relatives here.
So in other words, reducing may be beneficial in the sense that you're making sure that the core services are there before growing again. And I actually was speaking with Ken Quinn, who had worked for Governor Ray during the time that much of this happened and then later on became an ambassador to Cambodia. But is this decision actually shining a spotlight on this issue at a time when maybe some of us had forgotten about the program or forgotten about the work? Ms. Verisco, could there be a benefit almost to this reduction temporarily in the sense that maybe more people will be aware of this?
I think it would be a benefit, not only that, to keep these issues that are happening in all over the world and sometimes are based on some of the decisions that are happening in the U.S., some others are dictatorships that are happening in other countries, but also to keep fresh that these are the struggles of first generations. And Iowa has a lot of second, third, and fourth generation currently, and maybe they are not aware about their own first generation story. And these are similar struggles that they brought when the Irish and the Polish and Germans and Italians were here. So I think it keeps that fresh about we have been a state welcoming foreigners and immigrants, and so that will be one benefit. And then the other one about the number, I think it also will give a break to the school system and healthcare providers to adjust and accommodate. The ethnic groups have been changing dramatically, so it takes a while until you create a workforce to provide services. So now that the people has been here for 1 or 2 years, then they can be hired and provide services to their own ethnic groups.
Even just to have enough translators to welcome a new group in can be an issue, can't it?
Correct. And that's what's been happening with Arabic, for example, with the Iraqis coming in because all the interpreters have been overseas. And so,
thank you so much for your time today. We really, really appreciate the discussion and you coming in to speak with us. We're going to turn now. 3 of 4 Tibetan students typically study at the University of Northern Iowa each year as part of a program involving about a dozen universities. This week, not only are the students on campus, so is the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhists, the Dalai Lama. Iowa Public Radio's Pat Blank reports for us.
The event was three years and hundreds of planning sessions in the making. And UNI's affiliation through the Tibet Fund was likely one of the reasons the Dalai Lama agreed to visit. After low-key tours and personal visits Monday, he was welcomed in rock star fashion Tuesday as he arrived for a panel discussion and keynote address. Sporting a red robe, socks, and sandals, he donned a red Indiana University visor prior to the panel discussion because, he said, it matched. He told the thousands in attendance he's just a simple monk.
For my part, I consider you just a simple human being. And your side also should consider me as another human being. So my talk, not something formal, sort of, or today, poetic sort of statement or like that. No, nothing. What I feel here, I express.
Although the Dalai Lama says his message is simple, people like Brian O'Connor hope to draw inspiration from it. O'Connor, who works for the Family Violence Prevention Fund, flew in from San Francisco.
The Dalai Lama's presence of talking about violence in our world is also bringing out a really important issue out in the public. So I deal specifically with relationship violence as well. So that's also where people feel like it's not necessarily my business to get involved. But until we all actually accept and recognize that violence doesn't have to be part of the human condition, then we're never really going to be able to change it.
Instead of taking a plane, UNI's Tibetan students needed only to walk across campus to see the Dalai Lama. One of them, Thak May, says he could never expect to see the exiled leader in India, where he has lived since 1959 after fleeing his homeland. Thak May says he was shocked to learn the Dalai Lama was coming to the small Iowa town where he is studying.
Before coming here, I was in India. So I haven't got a chance to meet him the way I did today, I mean this morning. So it was really a very good experience, and I'm happy that I have chosen UNI for my studies.
During his afternoon keynote address, the Dalai Lama spoke for nearly 90 minutes without notes. He delighted the crowd by wearing a purple UNI visor. Before he began, he warned the audience, however, they needed to listen carefully to his words.
Please, when you listen Dalai Lama's broken English, be careful. Otherwise, you might get, you see, wrong understanding like that. So sometimes I mistake pessimism and optimism like that. That is really serious, isn't it?
The Nobel Peace Prize Committee had no trouble understanding his message of compassion and nonviolence. In 1989, they awarded him their highest honor. Not everyone is pleased with him, however. His very presence sparked the UNI Chinese Students and Scholars Association to issue a 12-page statement against all the publicity. An area near the arena designated for their protest, however, was empty all day. In Cedar Falls, I'm Pat Blank, Iowa Public Radio News.
And this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck. That piece, of course, Pat Blank with the Dalai Lama in Iowa City, or in Cedar Falls yesterday at the University of Northern Iowa. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Technical support comes from Dennis Reese and John Pemble. Remember, podcasting and on-demand audio available at iowapublicradio.org.